Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders' planned visit to the region, a new YMCA recently opened in Crown Point, Brandon Smith reports on the Indiana Senate approving an expansion Monday of the state's Stand Your Ground law, and Chris Nolte has a conversation with Mel McMahon Stone of Indiana Originals. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders will visit battleground states in the Midwest on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. Sanders will hold rallies in Madison, Wisconsin, Warren, Michigan, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He will also meet with community members in Gary, Indiana, and union workers in Coopersville, Michigan, and Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. On Saturday, April 13th at 9:15 a.m., Senator Sanders will host a community meeting in Gary at the Genesis Center. However, please note this event is closed to the public. Sanders will end the swing with a stop in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania to participate in a town hall hosted by Fox News. The tour will emphasize that Democrats' clearest and strongest path to victory in 2020 runs through the upper Midwest and that Bernie Sanders is by far the best positioned candidate to win these states and defeat Donald Trump. At rallies in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, three states that flipped and voted for Donald Trump in 2016, Sanders will deliver a message focused on fighting against unfair trade deals that undermine workers' wages and enrich CEOs. Rebuilding and strengthening unions, and guaranteeing health care as a right to all with Medicare for all.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
A judge has entered not guilty pleas on behalf of a 75-year-old, self-described, retired drag queen charged with murder in the fatal stabbing of a man in Gary who allegedly used a gay slur during a dispute. The Times reports Edward Miller appeared Wednesday before late criminal court judge Diane Boswell. His lawyer, Casey McCloskey, describes the case as unusual. Police responded March 26 to an apartment building in Gary and found 64-year-old Carlos Johnson, who had multiple stab wounds. Police say he was taken to a hospital and later died. Officers followed a trail of blood from a hallway and found Miller. An affidavit says that Miller told police he and Johnson were drinking and arguing when Johnson used a slur and called him a, quote, whore.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
An Indianapolis man has been charged with murder in the fatal shootings of a 13-year-old boy and his 35-year-old mother at their Gary home. On Tuesday, the Gary Police Department announced charges against 39-year-old Darren Duke Taylor. Police say Taylor was arrested last week in Indianapolis and is being held in the Lake County Jail. He's also charged with burglary. Lavelle Edmond and his mother Tamia Haywood were killed March 23rd. Court records say that Taylor's father had once dated Haywood. One of Haywood's daughters escaped the shooting by jumping from a second-floor window. Police earlier released surveillance images showing two men near the Gary home and urged anyone with information to contact investigators. The other man is still at large.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Auditors with the state of Indiana have raised concerns about oversight in child nutrition and special education accounts for Munster's school district. The Times reports the audit published by the Indiana State Board of Accounts covers July 1, 2016 to June 30, 2018 and draws attention to the district's cash management and property procurement as they relate to federally funded school breakfast and lunch programs. The audit says in one instance, the school town of Munster purchased over $400,000 in kitchen equipment without proper federal approval. The Munster District notes in a response that it's more than willing to take on the responsibility and will be accountable in resolving and correcting the issues that were identified. It says steps are already being taken to make improvements.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
The $35 million Dean and Barbara White Southlake YMCA was officially unveiled Thursday to the Crown Point community. About 300 people attended the dedication, where not only was the new 9-acre expansion to the existing Y celebrated, but also the community members and the donors who poured their devotion into the project. It was the Dean and Barbara White family gift of $20 million that led the way to the new facility, or as Craig White, one of the children, called it, a Destination Y. The Post Tribune reports Jay Buckmaster, CEO of Crossroads YMCA, which operates the branches in Griffith, Hammond, and Whiting, in addition to the Southlake Y, said in the next 60 days, the new Y is expected to see an increase from 20,000 visits a month to more than 60,000 visits. Buckmaster also said that the Y's membership and participation is expected to grow 20,000 people, up from just under 13,000 currently. Crown Point Mayor David Uran called the new Y a game changer, not only for Crown Point, but for the entire region. The city, as a way to represent its residents in supporting the project and as their own contribution, assisted the Y's expansion by waiving the building and permit fees that would have amounted to more than a couple hundred thousand dollars. Also assisting with the Y's expansion was Franciscan Health, which donated the 9 acres it owned next to its hospital for the project. The White family also purchased about 30 acres directly west of the Y for additional programming that will begin in the fall in what will be known as the Rich Parks Memorial Sports Complex. The existing facility will close April 11th for renovations through August.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Environmental Protection Agency's residential soil cleanup at East Chicago's Superfund site may wrap up this year. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman reports this is the end of one of many phases in the federal agency's cleanup plan.
EPA soil remediation began in 2016. It's cleaned up nearly 600 residential properties. Today, 170 additional properties are slated for cleanup. That number could grow to more than 200 as remaining yards are tested. Remedial project manager Sarah Rolfes lists the next steps.
All of our sites go into a five-year review program. Every 5 years, we review the remediation, the cleanup that was done, and make sure that it's still protective.
Looking ahead, the agency is still working with the city to determine the remediation standard for the former West Calumet housing complex location, and the EPA is in the beginning stages of a groundwater study, which could take a couple of years to complete. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lauren Chapman.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana marks a milestone with the addition of an alternative court in Pulaski County. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports on the state's 100th problem-solving court.
Problem-solving courts tackle the underlying issues people face, including substance abuse and mental health. The latest specialized court to be certified in Indiana is a veterans treatment court. The court offers treatment instead of incarceration and involves judges and community service teams who work with individuals to navigate the system. Treatment plans may include regular court appearances, medication compliance, drug screening, and therapy. Indiana now has problem-solving courts in 50 counties. Drug courts are the most common type. Hoosiers who live in counties without problem-solving courts may request a transfer. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Two bills penalizing those who share intimate or pornographic images without a person's consent cleared the Indiana House. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports the two measures create penalties in both criminal and civil court.
There's nothing in Indiana law to punish what's commonly referred to as revenge porn, distribution of pornographic images or videos without someone's consent. Representative Mike Speedy's bill makes it a Class A misdemeanor to do so and a Level 6 felony if an offender does it more than once. Speedy points to the recent case of a Hamilton County, Indiana teacher.
Formerly married woman who ex-husband distributed images throughout the community and the police were wanting to help her but couldn't.
Representative Sharon Nagel's bill creates monetary penalties in civil court for revenge porn.
And this is one tool in the tool chest to hopefully stop some of these problems that are occurring in our society.
Both measures head back to the Senate. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Indiana Senate approved legislation Monday that allows 12 and 13-year-olds accused of attempted murder to be tried in adult court. People that age accused of murder can already be moved to adult court, and Republican Senator Aaron Hochin says it makes sense to do the same for those tried for attempted murder.
It shouldn't be that just because the victim doesn't die, that that perpetrator can't be held to account and justice served for those victims.
The measure comes out of a school shooting in Noblesville, Indiana last year, where the 13-year-old shooter had to be tried as a juvenile. Democratic Senator Greg Taylor says the bill is, quote, vindictive justice.
It doesn't justify us making a public policy decision for one circumstance.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Republican Senator Todd Young authored a bill he hopes will attract nurses to underserved areas of the country. Co-sponsored by a Democrat, the proposal would offer nurses incentives in the form of loan repayments and scholarships if they work for a hospital that's in critical need of their skills. In Indiana, many of those facilities are in rural areas. Dina Dodd is the Network Development Officer for Indiana's Rural Health Association. She says nearly all of Indiana's 35 critical access hospitals will have a need for more nurses.
If they don't fall into this category right now, in the next couple of years, they will definitely fall into this category.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Indiana Senate approved an expansion Monday on the state's Stand Your Ground law. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brenda Smith reports on the heated hour-long.
Indiana's Stand Your Ground law protects you from criminal charges if you use force to defend yourself, your property, or someone else. The proposed bill extends that to civil court. It says a criminal can't sue the person who used that justified force on them. Democratic Senator Karen Tallien says the bill provides immunity for, quote, vigilante justice.
You go out and you shoot somebody that you maybe think is doing wrong. I mean, this is right out of Charles Bronson.
But Republican Senator Mike Young says that's not the case.
If a jury finds and it goes to trial that you didn't have justification, you don't get immunity under this bill.
The measure goes back to the House. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The central message of Monday's State of Higher Education address is one Hoosiers have heard before. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports, it focused on the need for a more skilled workforce.
The Commissioner for Higher Education, Teresa Lubbers, reinforced one of Governor Eric Holcomb's biggest priorities during her annual State of Higher Education address.
More than ever, the imperative to develop human capital is the most critical issue facing the state of Indiana.
And in order to do that, she says education officials and employers need to work together. Lubbers stressed the importance of higher education changing to meet the needs of more adult learners. She says Indiana's largest industries are likely to see more automated jobs, but people with more education have a lower risk of losing their jobs to automation. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The 2019 session's major gaming bill underwent a makeover Tuesday in the House Ways and Means Committee. The biggest change? Lawmakers severed the ties between a Gary Casino and potential new casino in Terre Haute. Previously, the bill allowed the Gary Casino to move one of its two licenses to Terre Haute. But now, Vigo County voters have the power to clear the way for a new license with a ballot referendum, regardless of what happens in Gary. Representative Todd Houston said that new facility would be subject to an open, competitive bidding process among casino operators.
They would outline what their investment would be, what the facility would look like, is it multi-use, is it multi-purpose.
the Gary Casino could still move inland to a more advantageous location in the city. Doing so would cost $50 million, down from $100 million in a previous version of the bill. The Ways and Means Committee also lowered some of the state's gambling taxes for all casinos, which would take effect in 2 years. Ryan Soltz is from Boyd Gaming, which owns a Michigan City casino. He says it appreciates the tax changes, but still opposes the Gary Casino move.
The tax provisions in this bill do not offset the potential revenue impact that we're going to see in Michigan City.
The committee also added to the bill a new tax on sports wagering, which the bill legalizes. But it left untouched language that limits those bets to casinos only, rather than mobile sports gaming, which the bill's original version allowed.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
After substantial changes were made to this session's gaming bill, an amendment was added Thursday to increase transparency. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman reports that amendment was in response to a report that Governor Eric Holcomb had met privately with the Gary Casino's CEO.
An Indianapolis Star report detailed two flights Governor Eric Holcomb took with Spectacle Entertainment CEO Rod Ratcliffe. The company owns the Gary Casino and would stand to benefit from the gaming legislation. It allows the casino to move to a more lucrative location off the waterfront. It also provides a $50 million decrease in the cost of moving the casino. Democrat Representative Patrick Bauer objected to Holcomb's private meetings with the CEO and proposed an amendment to require lawmakers to make those types of meetings public.
They were constantly saying somebody's going to go to jail from this General Assembly. And the reason they said that is because in every other state, gambling brought legislators into jail.
The amendment prevailed 61-28. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lauren Chapman at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Senate lawmakers this week approved legislation that aims to sharpen state law surrounding animal cruelty. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brenda Smith reports the measure doesn't go as far as its author originally wanted.
The original legislation created broader definitions of animal cruelty and increased the criminal penalties for abusing animals. Representative Ryan Hatfield says it's important to give law enforcement the tools they need to go after animal abusers.
What we know about animal crimes, without a doubt, people who abuse animals abuse people, and they abuse children.
But Senate lawmakers worried that the increased penalties weren't proportional to crimes against people, so they stripped out those provisions. They did add something to the bill. New language governing animal shelters, says Senator Vanita Becker.
They have to use humane euthanasia for pets. They can't use gas chambers anymore.
The legislature might study increased animal cruelty penalties this summer. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Teachers around Indiana rallied Wednesday in support of increasing teacher pay beyond what Republicans in the Indiana General Assembly have approved. Governor Eric Holcomb has led the push for adding 2% to what the state puts into its K-12 education budget, but educators like West Lafayette High School science teacher Andy Hipscher says that's not enough.
We feel that the 2% will barely even cover raises, and they're taking money from us in other places. So in some corporations, ours included, we might end up having a net loss.
Democrats have complained too much money is going to charter and virtual schools, and they claim the governor's proposal to free up dollars elsewhere isn't likely to translate into larger paychecks for classroom employees. West Lafayette State Representative Chris Campbell, who was elected to her first term in November, largely on a platform of improving teacher pay, she thinks even if schools can free up those dollars, needs such as building maintenance will come up first.
I think the schools don't have the money to do that. The schools can't do that unless they get rid of teachers to do that. If they can't fund the teachers that they have with the money that they're getting, they're actually going to have to cut teachers.
Still, teachers at the West Lafayette rally say they're not ready yet to walk off the job as West Virginia teachers did in early 2018 and early 2019.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A controversial bill regarding erosion on construction sites is headed back to the State House. It wouldn't allow local governments to make stricter erosion control rules than state ones. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, there's one exception.
Legislators recently amended the bill to allow local governments to make stricter erosion control regulations for projects covering less than an acre of land. The state doesn't currently have rules for these very small construction sites. Carrie Daly is with the Indiana Association for Floodplain and Stormwater Management. He says the sites tend to be closer to the road, and so sediment can more quickly find its way into storm drains and then local waterways.
There's a lot less room for error on these sites, and from what we've heard from some of our members, that those are the sites they get the most public complaints about.
Daly says local governments should be allowed to make rules that are stricter than what the state requires to protect sensitive areas like parks and wetlands. Proponents of the bill say it would make erosion control rules more consistent across the state. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
University of St. Francis professor Dr. Adam DeVille has written a new book addressing the Catholic sex abuse scandal. A teacher of ecclesiology, Dr. DeVille believes some of the solution could lie in other liturgical Christian traditions, specifically the Anglican and Eastern Orthodox churches. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Green sat down with him last month to talk about the book.
I am here in the studio with Dr. Adam DeVille. He's an associate professor and director of humanities at the University of St. Francis. Dr. DeVille, you came in today. We asked you to come in and talk about your new book. You teach ecclesiology, which is kind of the relationship between churches and faith groups.
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about your book and who you wrote it for.
Yes, thank you. The book is called Everything Hidden Shall Be Revealed, Ridding the Church of Abuses of Sex and Power. And I really wrote it primarily for the Catholic Church, but drawing on the experience of Orthodox Christians and Anglican Christians as well, because I think both of them have something to offer the Catholic Church today as it's struggling to find ways to reform and to restructure itself in light of the ongoing sex abuse crisis.
What are some of those things that you have observed in the Anglican community and Eastern Orthodoxy that could offer some change to the Roman Catholic Church?
It's a really simple one that I think will be easy to implement in the Catholic world that both Anglicans and many Orthodox, especially the Armenians, do. And that is to have every parish, every local community is required to have a parish council. Currently in the Catholic world, they're optional. My book argues that they have to be mandatory and they have to have both voice and vote for the people on the parish council, neither which exists right now in the Catholic world. And I do that because one of the big problems in the abuse crisis is the priests being moved around, shuffled around in secrecy, and nobody knows why, you know, Father so-and-so is here on Sunday of this week, and next week he's gone, and there's this new guy here. We don't know anything about why the old guy left, or why the new guy's here, or where he comes from. And that's how a lot of bishops dealt with the problem of abusive priests. They moved them around and didn't tell anybody. So one of the proposals I argue is you now have to have the parish council be told why this priest is leaving and be told about the background of the new guy coming in so that there's no more of this shuffling people around in secrecy. The bishops have to be held accountable to the people because the people have a right to know who their pastors are and what their background is.
That seems like a very simple solution, and it kind of comes as news to me that many Roman Catholic churches do not have a parish council. When we think of a parish council, would you have in mind a one that is made up of both men and women?
Absolutely. Many parishes in the Catholic world today do have parish councils, but they're optional. And the priest doesn't have to have one in the first place, and he doesn't have to listen to them, even if he does have one. So I argue they're no longer optional, they're mandatory. And they have the right of voice and vote, so the priest can't ignore them or sideline them. And I do that because too often they have been ignored, too often they have been sidelined. And so they are given now the responsibility for looking at problems within the parish. And I argue that this has to be balanced. I don't get into really fine details about how many, for example, but if you take, you know, your average committee of, say, 10 people, I think there's no reason why it shouldn't be 50-50 men and women on the parish council, working with the priest and with the bishop, so that all three of these, you know, the bishops, the priests, and the people have a responsibility for the communities that they're a part of.
What are some other potential solutions you've identified to kind of break this cycle that seems to kind of every 15 years or so, there's like another wave of Absolutely. Allegations,
yep.
and they seem almost more horrific than the wave before.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so I start with the parish, start with the local parish council proposal, because that's closest to home, and then I move up to successive levels. I move up to the regional or the diocesan levels, as it's called, to argue a similar change there, that people in the parishes and parish clergy have to be involved in the governance of the local diocese. Including something that we haven't seen in the Catholic world for over 100 years, but we still have in Anglicanism and Orthodoxy, which is the election of bishops. There is no reason why bishops can't be elected locally and held accountable to their people. And I lay forth a proposal in that book how that's happened in the Catholic world in the past, how it still happens in the Orthodox and Anglican worlds today, and why that's an important piece for Catholics to consider. No longer do you have these bishops able to get around accountability, but now they have to face their people, they have to be elected by their people, and they're accountable to their people for what they do and don't do when it comes to abuse, but really to any other issues as well, financial mismanagement and so on.
What are some other structural changes that you would recommend? The Catholic Church is large mm-hmm. and vast mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. Very top-down.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and in fact, I start with that in the first chapter of the book. I say that the biggest change that we need to begin with is psychological. We need to think differently about how we imagine the church because of the top-down focus, because of this heavy personality cult that's developed around the popes for the last 200 years. I argue that we have to stop this focus on the pope, stop standing around waiting for him to tell us what to do, waiting for him to say, well, you can do this and not this. And take the initiative to do things locally and regionally without waiting for either a yes or a no from Rome. Because, in fact, that's not his job in the first place. And we've allowed him to get away with these kind of power grabs. And, in fact, a lot of us have liked that. You know, if you recall back even to November of last year when the American bishops met, stood around and did nothing because they said, well, we can't hold each other accountable. It's the pope's job, you know. Well, there's one pope in the world, and there's 3,500 bishops. How much do you think he's going to have time to stand around and look at what 3,500 bishops are doing? He doesn't. He can't. You know, organizational theorists tell us today, you know.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Mel McMahon Stone of Indiana Originals.
There is a business called Indiana Originals. It's been around for a while. It's celebrating a fifth anniversary, as a matter of fact, this year. But to find out more about what the company does and how it is expanding into Northwest Indiana, let's turn to one of the co-owners of Indiana Originals, Mel McMahon Stone. And Mel, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this is probably a company that most folks up here in the region have not heard of. Tell us how you and your husband got Indiana Originals started and what Indiana Originals does.
Oh, I'm happy to. We go all the way back to 2012. My now husband and I were walking around Monument Circle here in downtown Indianapolis, and we wanted to go someplace local for dinner. And we threw out a restaurant name, and I looked at my husband and I said, well, is that actually local? And he said, I don't know. And I said, well, how do you know if it's local? And that's what kind of started it all. You know, we started researching. There wasn't a directory. There wasn't a sticker. Apps weren't really that big in 2012 yet, so there wasn't an app. And there was really no one that was defining local as independently owned in Indiana. And so in May of 2014, we launched what we call Indiana Originals. So we help you find local, independent, Indiana-based businesses faster and easier.
And I know the side benefit, I guess, of this, of not only finding the businesses for whatever case you may want to, whether it's finding some place to eat or some service of some type, it's to help build the community as well.
It is. We are very much community-based. Our mission is to create healthier, stronger communities and more jobs in Indiana by encouraging and facilitating a greater use of independent Indiana original businesses. So not only do we help consumers find these businesses faster and easier, we help our members find the resources they need to be successful.
In getting started 5 years ago, did you have a good source, I guess, of ready businesses that might become members of the Indiana Originals family, so to speak? Or did you have to really search out there to find them?
Well, fortunately, here in Indianapolis, I have a pretty strong network. My background is actually in broadcasting, so I've been in television and radio for just as long as I've been in business development. So when I started researching and started talking to people about this, I quickly found out that there were a lot of people like me. They want to support these local businesses. They want to know who really is making the biggest economic impact in our communities and in our neighborhoods. And so when I launched, we had about 40 businesses that jumped on board that first year while we were really still trying to figure out exactly what we were and what we were going to be.
Mm-hmm. Now, since you're based in central Indiana, did all of those businesses seem to be based there around Indianapolis and vicinity, or did you have a chance to start branching out? When did you reach out from beyond central Indiana into northwest Indiana?
Most of our members are here in central Indiana, but my husband is actually from Warren County, so just west of Purdue. Mm-hmm. And so we have members in Warren County and Benton County. We have a member, Freedom Foods, in Wolcott, Indiana. They just jumped on board. So we have, kind of this cluster in northwest Indiana. We started talking to businesses in South Bend. And we have businesses as far south as DuBois County, in Jasper, Indiana, that have joined, because they all believe in the mission. They are proud to be here in Indiana. These business owners want people to know that they're local and that they are really contributing to the community. And the more we can spend that money locally, the more everybody wins. And so actually, because we are starting to grow so much outside of central Indiana, we have really kind of evaluated our community and our events and how we're handling things. And so right now we're in the very exciting process of rebuilding our website and really building an online community that's going to kind of be a mix of some of the websites that are out there now that we're already using, but it's going to be more community-based. So you don't have to just be a member, to participate in our forums and find out what's going on. As a consumer, you can ask for businesses that do certain things or ask for businesses to participate in your charity event, and it doesn't all have to get funneled through me anymore. So I'm very, very excited about this new launch and how it's really going to grow among all the 92 counties here in Indiana.
Now, speaking of growth here, how many members would you say that you have with Indiana Originals now, and what types of businesses and services do they represent?
Well, we have over 200 members, and just to clarify, we do charge a fee for membership. So mm-hmm. We have a certification process, and then you pay to be a member, because that membership gives you access to lots of different resources and lots of different discounts. So we are not a free membership service like some other ones. But we have everything from, coffee shops and bakeries to real estate agents to insurance agents. We have nonprofit organizations, photographers, automotive, car repair shops. We have, different places that you can go, different attractions. It's all different categories because we want to show people that it's easy to live a local lifestyle if you know where to look.
Now, since you're mostly focusing on buy local or shop local, I guess maybe I should say, we know that recently Walmart's announced that, at least in Indiana, that they are looking for more vendors for their supply chain. How does Indiana Originals, how does it fit in with the Walmart concept?
So something that's really interesting about Indiana Originals and our organization is that we try really hard to be the partner between national and local. So there are a lot of community-centric programs that really just focus on, a neighborhood or a county, but they don't really go beyond that. Our goal is to help our members grow to whatever level they want to be. So we kind of act as a middleman sometimes on behalf of our members. So, for example, with the Indianapolis International Airport and their big revamp of their concessions program, we were right there through the entire process, fighting for local, helping local businesses get acknowledged. And we're still going to work with these businesses in the airport to make sure local products are there available for travelers. And so with a situation like Walmart, that's the same thing. We have people that come to our website as buyers, and they look for different items that they're interested in, and then we help connect them to that member to get that process going, get that process started. And then if our members are not familiar with these situations, or maybe they haven't scaled up to that level yet, we help educate them and find them the resources that they need to be able to get in front of these big buyers and get into those stores.
Now, if anybody's interested in finding out more about Indiana Originals, or for that matter, if there's a small business out there that is interested in becoming part of the Indiana Originals family, how do they do so?
It's very simple. You just go to IndianaOriginals.com, and as long as your business is headquartered here in Indiana, locally owned and operated, and not part of a franchise that's headquartered out of state, you qualify. And right now, membership starts at just $10 a month. So we try to make it very attainable for everybody, no matter whether you've been in business for days or for decades.
Well, Mel, thanks for being with us to talk a little bit about Indiana Originals, and we'll look forward to seeing the updates on the website and finding out more, and maybe find more besides Wolcott and maybe eventually South Bend and some of the other areas here in Northwest Indiana that might have businesses that want to join the Indiana Originals family. Thanks for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Mel McMahon Stone is one of the co-owners of Indiana Originals.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.